All right, welcome to the Erie Music History Podcast. I'm Chip Shell, your host, and today's guest is the first person I've had on the podcast that I've actually been in a band with.
All right.
He's been mentioned in lots of episodes in the past, including the ones with Tim McLaughlin, Paul Holmes, Bob Tome, probably other ones. I know there's other ones. He's 71 years old. Is that what you are?
Okay, now this cat's out of the bag.
And you play in like three different bands. You're super active these days. Welcome, Scott Campbell, to the podcast.
Well, thanks, Dan. I'm going to call you Dan because that's what I always knew you as, Dan.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Well, let it be known that years ago, we did actually work together.
That's how we met. Yeah, back at Lear, in the day, back in the 90s, early 90s, and then we actually played together for the first time at a Christmas party, I think.
Yes, right? We did.
And I had no idea the rock royalty that I was working with at the time.
Well,
I mean, Scott, you've been in so many of the big bands and over the years and stuff. And like I said, lots of folks mention you. You sent me 50 some photos of, you know, all sorts of bands and great musicians. Joel Miller, we should point out also, who was your manager in Red, White, and Blueberry. Joel is the expert at Red, White, and Blueberry. He sent me some photos and some information too. So thanks to Joel right up front. But let's get into it. So,
all right.
We did have a little bit of a talk beforehand, chronology, how we're going to go about this. And I said, I've heard of a lot of your bands, but those early days of what molded Scott, you know, I don't know those stories, you know. And so you obviously... here's where I'll start. You sent me a picture, and there's four guys with basses, stand-up basses.
Ah!
Did you play stand-up bass, too? I always think of you just as a guitar player.
Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. We'll cover that.
All right, great. So when do you start playing guitar?
Okay, so since now you did give my age, I will be 71 in August.
The youngest-looking 71 I've ever known.
I was actually born in Cleveland in 1952, and I actually went to a Catholic grade school, and when I was in third grade, the music school across the street from St. Henry's Church and elementary school came in and said, hey, if anybody wants to take music lessons, you know, we're here, and... I think I wanted to play drums, but that didn't work out. But I did pick guitar. And actually, there's a reason for that. I joke about the drums, only probably because I wanted to drive my parents crazy. But so this is 1960, 61.
Okay, all right.
This is before...
The Beatles?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And my inspiration was watching the Ozzie and Harriet show.
What? I don't get it. Did they... play guitar on that show?
Do you know who Ozzie and Harriet were?
I know the show, yeah.
It's Ricky Nelson's parents. At the end of each show, he would come out and play a song.
Really?
Yes.
I had no idea. All right.
Yeah, with his band, usually.
All right, I'm 58, so I was watching those things in reruns.
So I was like, I want to be, you know, I want to be in a band. I want to play guitar.
So
this
he
is
was
cool
young.
Stuff.
He was young.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was, yeah. I'm not sure how I would have should have looked that up to see how old he was. So I was taking lessons, learning all the rudimentary things. Back then, lessons were much different. It was the Mel Bay method.
Sure, yeah.
It's not like today where it's like, you know, you pick up a guitar and you're playing, you know, Metallica the next day or something. It was 6 months before they let me play a chord.
And this is in Cleveland still?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
So a number of years later, when I was 11 years old, I moved to Erie, so that would have been like 63 or 64.
All right.
And if you recall, the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan February 9th of 1964.
Sure, right.
So now everybody wants to be a guitar player, wants to be a Beatle.
Right,
so,
right. Yeah.
So, now I'm in seventh grade, and people kind of know... Who's doing what? Some people knew I played guitar.
You're still in Cleveland?
No. I moved to Erie.
Oh, okay.
I moved to Erie in 63, 64. So so now I'm at Gridley Junior High. And I hook up with Chris Sorcy.
Okay, I've heard the name. Yeah.
And he played guitar a little bit, but had a great voice, a good singer. And I said, well, you know, we want to start a band. And then I'm not sure really how we all kind of found each other. Kenny Walko was also in our class. That was Bob Walko's younger brother.
Brother, right. Yeah.
And he played drums.
Okay.
So we started rehearsing as this band. And my brother was 2 years older, and he played sax, and he did some things with us, too.
Oh,
but we didn't have a bass player, so we had two guitar players, a drummer, sometimes a sax player.
Okay.
And we would practice over in Chris's garage, so we were really a garage band.
Yeah.
Over on Crescent Avenue, over kind of near 4th and Cockwood, that area.
Okay, some yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
So we play, and all the little neighborhood kids would come, and we'd play. So.
This is the Phaetons, or the Phaetons?
Well, no,
the,
actually, it, we were originally the Strangers.
Ooh.
I don't have a card for that one.
I love early band names. Yeah.
So that was Chris, Chris Sorcy, Ken Walk on drums, my brother on sax, and the only gig that I remember was that we opened up for Bob Walko's band, which was the Marauders, I believe, at the time. I think it was in the basement of Luther Memorial Church or something.
Okay. All right.
So it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine. I was recounting some of these old gigs, and it says, it's funny how you remember these things because you remember what you wore. So we're kind of this surf band, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
We had these blue Henley shirts with white ribbing around the collars, and we had mattress bucket hats.
Oh, wow. Who? Where do you get this stuff?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, wish I still had it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I don't, you know, because you had to have an outfit.
Yeah,
you know,
right, back then.
So that lasted for a while. You know, we didn't, that's the only gig I remember doing.
And did you play in a band called Midnight's Creation?
Not to my recollection.
All right, because I found a 1967, it said Scott Campbell, Jim Graves, Tom Hayne, and Lee Sherman, and Rick Foster played in a band called Midnight's Creation.
Okay.
And that was
I think.
He played at a Baptist church for a mother-daughter banquet. It was the only gig I could find.
That was, I think, in like the mid-60s.
67.
Yeah, 67.
Yeah, right.
And I'm going to get to that. I didn't know that that was the name of the band. I had another name. So anyhow, we go from the Strangers. Now we realize, Chris and I realize, we need to get this thing off the ground. We need a bass player. So we said, okay, we already have Bob Walko's brother, Kenny, playing drums. So we went to Sumner Nichols,
right.
Was the drummer for the Marauders, Bob Walko's band.
So and he's the attorney.
Yes.
Right? Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And his brother was in our class, Doug Nichols.
Oh.
So he said, hey, Doug, buy a bass and an amp, and you can be in our band.
And that's all it took?
Yeah. He bought a beautiful EBO Gibson bass and a Vox amp.
Nice.
We won't mention what his dad did us.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, right. That's nice equipment.
But anyhow, you know, so yeah. That was, so Doug joined the band. It was great. Doug, if you're out there.
Wow.
So we played, you know, we're in eighth grade.
Okay.
We can't play clubs or anything.
Right.
We would play parties. I vividly remember playing birthday parties at, is it Stephanie's Grove?
Sure. Stephanie's Catering there.
Yeah.
In Oregon.
They had a building there, and kids would have parties there and things
I've
like that.
I've heard that before.
Yeah. But the highlight of our career, I believe, was our ninth grade Gridley variety show.
Ah, okay.
And I remember what we wore.
You remember what you played?
No.
No.
No, I do remember. I believe we played Day Tripper.
Oh.
Maybe we can work it out. Some Beatles, mostly probably Beatles stuff.
No Wipeout or anything like
that? No, we're off that track now.
Okay.
We're all British Invasion by that
gotcha.
Point.
Yeah,
we're all British Invasion by that point. So we had these acrylic fuzzy kind of turtleneck sweaters. I think mine was orange. I think the other guys were orange, and Chris's was this bright green. I don't know. Why do I remember something?
I was going
like
to say, I never thought this conversation was going to go
no,
down
I
the
never
path
did
of
either.
Clothing,
no,
you know,
I love it.
I love it.
I'm going off track.
Yeah.
So anyhow, you know, we're doing that. And you mentioned Midnight's Creation. So Tom Hayne, who was another kid from our class, who played bass, he said, oh, I want you to come over and jam with some of my friends here. You know, we have this little band going. It would be great. And it seemed like maybe they were going to be doing something more. I believe the drummer was Lonnie Sherman, who I knew. who lived up the street from me. And there's Tom and then Rick Foster on guitar.
Right.
And Jim Graves was a singer. And he was much older, I believe.
Oh.
He was older than us. I mean, maybe by a few years. At one point, maybe this was just a joke, but I believe at one time we called the band Jim Graves and the Tombstones of Eternity.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I can only imagine who thought that name up.
Yeah. So it's I've taken a Midnight's Creation, yeah.
All right.
So, and apparently you remember, you have documentation of the gigs more than I do, because I do not remember.
Yeah, you played at the Delaware Avenue Baptist Church for the mother-daughter banquet.
Oh, I got that gig because my parents went there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to say, how the heck do you land that gig? That's the only thing I found.
Yeah.
Okay.
So apparently, apparently I played there. So,
you're at Gridley still.
I'm at Gridley still. And so when I was now going into 10th grade, I'm not sure what happened if I was still in the Tombstones of Eternity or Midnight's Creation or whatever. I was now, previously I was living down by the bay in a rented house like on Beverly Drive in that area. So I hung out with like Chris lived down the corner of that area and Doug lived in a frontier area. So I knew a lot of people down there. So now all of a sudden we move into the city on West 9th Street between Walnut and Cherry. And right down the street from me, on the corner of 9th and Cherry, live Dr. Snow and his family.
Yeah.
So Tony was in my class. Dr. Ross Anthony Snow.
Yeah, right.
And Danny, his older brother.
Okay.
So I started hanging out with these people.
Yeah.
And there was a fella down the street also, Chuck Siegel, who played guitar. So one day I think I'm 16, because I know I was fairly young. Get a call from Chuck, say, hey, this band I'm in, one of our band members can't make it to a gig in Brookville.
So they're playing out of town.
And we could use a guitar player. And I think my parents were out of town because I said, I'll take a road trip. It was Jimmy D and the Citations.
Oh, wow. All right.
Yeah. So they used to be just the Citations.
Right.
And then James Dombravo was the lead singer.
Okay.
And believe it or not, on occasion played Cordovox.
Oh, wow.
Which was basically an electronic kind of accordion.
Yeah.
But it had organ sounds, so you can make it sound more like a
Harry
Hammond
Parker
or something.
Has burned that into my brain. He reminds me every time that I should know what a Cordovox is.
Okay.
This time in the podcast. So, Harry, if you're listening, I know what he was talking
about.
All
right. So we go play this. Oh, go.
And is Tony singing?
No. Okay. It's Jim DeBravo. That was a side note. I was just saying I was in this neighborhood where these folks were, because these different people that I met, like Tony and Danny and then Chuck Siegel.
So this is the Citations.
So Citations, I remember.
Was Henry playing for them at the time?
Who?
Didn't Henry Temporsky play for them?
What did he play?
Guitar? No.
Maybe he's the one who left. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. All right.
I know there's some old pictures up there.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Right.
That one at like.
No, I think it was just me and Chuck on guitar.
Okay, all right.
And I think sometimes James DeBravo would cover the bass on his Cordovox.
Gotcha.
I think later on we did have a bass player.
Interesting.
I don't remember. Right. I'm not sure who the drummer was at the time. So we're playing. I said, this is great. You know, they're playing gigs. I'm getting paid.
Yeah.
Staying in hotels or whatever. It was like, it was kind of weird because most of the guys were older than me. It was strange.
I mean, you're still in high school.
Oh, yeah. We do this gig and we got this hotel room and it's like, they have girls in there. They're partying. And I'm sitting in a chair trying to get some sleep or something. I don't know. It was odd. So I didn't remember this. Somebody told me, and I think it might have been Richie Kowalczyk, who also reached out to a number of people in doing preparation for this I've reached out to, who hopefully had better memories than I did. I think that DeBravo either got drafted or enlisted or something.
Oh, okay.
So he was out of the picture. So now we're left with these other people.
Right.
I think with me and Chuck. And I'm not sure who is the drummer, but across the street from us, this fellow Denny Cray lived, and he used to play with Danny Snow, I think, in the Spectre of Time.
Ah, okay.
I might
heard that name
wrong.
Yeah.
I think that was Dan's band.
Okay.
But, you know, it's all in this neighborhood. So long story short, we start this band with me and Chuck, and I believe for a while, Denny Cray and Bob Madera, who lived out on Wolf Road, and he played organ, and we practiced and did some gigs, and we called the band the Music Box.
Okay.
I think it sent you a card.
Yeah, right.
And so the Music Box came out of the fact that the keyboard player just had this, like, as most people did, just like a combo organ.
Yeah.
Kind of the cheesy sounds of the time. And he had a big old wooden, probably had been a TV cabinet that he stuck speakers in and put some cloth over it. It looked kind of psychedelic.
Yeah.
And we used to call that the Music Box. It was, oh, we're the Music Box.
Sounds like something that Tim McLaughlin
made. So we played with that for a while. And, but then things sort of, I think the drummer left. I got a hold of Kenny, Chuck left, Richie Kowalczak came in.
Okay.
So this is now the beginnings of Stillwater. Ah. We're still the Music Box. Okay. So we were a three-piece. It was me, Richie Kowalczak on bass, and Ken Walco on drums.
But what was the picture that you gave me of you playing bass with Tony Snow singing?
So
was that TF in the Terminals or something like that?
That was in... yes. Where is that? I have it in my
1970
notes.
Maybe?
That was actually in 1968, because that's from the 1968 Strong Vincent yearbook.
Oh.
That was us playing at the Strong Vincent variety show, which was a big deal. The only thing was that you had to be a Vincent student.
Okay.
So, so Tony sang, my brother Frank Campbell... And Chuck Siegel was on guitar, and I played bass, and I believe that was Richie Kowalczak's Mustang bass.
Gotcha.
I'm not sure who was playing drums in that picture. I'd have to go back and look.
I don't know.
Oh, I think it was Mick Dragoon.
I thought his name was Rick, but yeah.
Well, there is a Rick Dragoon too.
Okay, sir.
His brother. We were called, what were we called? The Terminals...
Something, TF and the Terminals?
Oh, TF, yeah. Tony and Frank.
Ah.
Tony and Frank.
I didn't know what that meant.
The Terminals, yeah. So
that was like a one-time gig.
Yeah, that was a one-time thing. But it was a great picture, though.
Yeah, it is a great picture.
Yeah, it was a great picture. So now this Stillwater thing is kind of taking off. And
this is classic rock of the time. I mean, it wasn't even classic rock. It was new rock at that time.
It was new rock at the time. So we were doing things... obviously, we still did some Beatles, but we were doing kind of B-sides, like Bulldog.
Oh, okay.
We were doing Procol Harum with a three-piece band. We were doing...
Was there an organ?
Yeah, but we didn't have an organ.
Oh, okay.
It was just... Oh, just
no, I know. I assume. Just,
we were doing a lot of Steve Miller.
Okay.
It was new. It was like Living in the USA.
Right, yeah.
Kenny would always bring us songs, I think, that his brother liked or maybe his band was doing. Oh, yeah, this is great. And we do these songs. So we played. There was one picture there, I think, that I sent you of me with my Telecaster. And it was probably like at a college gig. We did a lot of stuff like that, private parties, some college gigs.
You played at the 1914 Thai Coffee House?
Probably.
You did?
He did.
Yeah. A lot of people mentioned that as a
I couldn't remember if it was that or if that was the later version of Stillwater.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, see, that's a problem. Some of these bands sort of metamorphosized into other bands.
Yeah, it seems like you played continually for many years, and sometimes there was some overlap.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of made it hard. I tried to do my spreadsheet.
Yeah, I got confused myself. Yeah.
I'm going down here. What happened there?
Because right now, chronology wise, we're in the early 70s, right?
70s. We're just getting that point. So it was 1968 to 69. You know, we did that variety show thing. Richie Kowalczak was still in the band. So now we're hitting 69 and 70.
Right.
And it's still just me, Kenny, and Richie in Stillwater. Now I'm a senior. At Vincent.
Okay.
And we wanted to play at the variety show. It was a really big deal. Yeah. I remember as a few years before, because I think Bob Walker was probably 3 years older than Kenny, seeing the Marauders play.
Yeah.
And they always had these, they all had these gray suits with the round collars. They all had matching silver tone amps, those piggyback silver tone amps and everything. It's like, oh man, we got to play this. Well, we couldn't play because our bass player, Richie, went to Tech.
Oh, okay. And everybody had to be a Vincent.
He actually printed our cards. You see those cards?
Yeah.
He was in the print shop.
All right.
Thanks, Richie. and so we looked around, and there was this guy who's a year younger than us, Mark Twist, who played bass.
Yeah.
And he was probably in a band with Tim McLaughlin at the time. Who knows?
Right.
I can't
Okay. Yeah.
I had to ask Tim about that one. And so we asked, hey, for the variety show, you want to play with us? And so we practiced, and we found out this kid can sing like Zeppelin.
Yeah.
So we're playing like Zeppelin stuff and probably some Black Sabbath, James Gang. Or
whatever.
And, you know, we had this show. We had a fellow who had a had some lights, probably just Christmas, you know,
the floodlights
or whatever.
Right.
But had a strobe light, you know, a real strobe light, I think. And we played this show and people were like, you go to our school? That's really cool. You know, it's like, and we're like, we feel like rock stars, you know? So we said, well, what are you going to do? You know,
we have this other bass player.
And I don't know. This is the way I like to put it. I suppose you could say that we sort of booted Richie, but sorry, I don't, no hard feelings. I like to say that we brokered a deal because here's what the end result was.
Yeah.
So the end result was good. Even if there was any tension, I don't really remember.
Right.
You know, Mark was actually, I was wrong. He wasn't playing in a band with Tim. He was in a band with Paul Eichert called Lincoln.
Oh, right.
Paul Eichert and Lee Taylor.
That's right, which was
he
super
was the
popular
bass
at the
Taylor
time. Right.
And Lincoln.
That's right.
So ultimately what happened, Richie went to play with Lincoln.
Yeah, right.
And Mark stayed with us.
That's right.
So how all that came to be, I'm not sure. But in my mind, it was all good.
But it's funny, like I mentioned the 1914 tie. You know, I mean, that's a place that, you're right, it was the later incarnation of you and Mark and Kenny. This is also the beginning of you playing an inordinate amount of arts festivals, like every year, it seems like in some different band. You also get to play where some other folks have played, which is super odd, at the Boston store. Like, do you remember even doing that? I have the advertisement for it. Like, they would have local bands come and set up throughout the Boston store and play to attract the younger crowd for the new fashion.
Now that you say it, it sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, I've had some other folks on, and I found the ad for it. You were scheduled to play the Big Follies End Music Festival that I don't know if it ever went off or not in 70. Like the Butterfield Blues.
Oh, Follies End.
Yeah.
Well, you know who actually owned Follies End?
Who?
Chris Sorcey's dad.
Oh, okay.
It was a campground.
Yeah.
To my recollection, yeah. Just to go back a year, because we mentioned this, there is a picture, in case people put it up, of me with three other people playing string basses.
Yeah, what happened?
So that was actually, I believe that was my first year at Vincent. That was 68 in 10th grade. So to go back a few years, just to pick up from that.
Yeah.
When I started at Gridley, they had like tryouts for orchestra and band. There's no place for a guitar player.
Oh, okay.
They didn't have jazz bands.
Right,
back there.
Right, right.
Not that I even knew a jazz quarter.
Yeah,
that.
Right, yeah.
Not like all these other guys that you talked to who took lessons, you know, and knew all the jazz chords. So they said, yeah, well, you know, we can always use bass players, and it's kind of the same thing.
I can tell you it's not.
Well, the four lower strings are the same notes.
Yeah, right, right.
But I had to learn to read bass clef.
Yeah.
And so they said, here's a bass. Take it home for the summer and learn how to play it.
Wow.
Which I kind of did. And then when in seventh, eighth, and ninth grade, I was kind of like, they worked with me to learn to play bass. So by the time I hit senior high school, I was in orchestra for 3 years playing string bass.
Stand-up bass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also let me do some little side gigs, which are kind of odd. There's not any documentation about this. Somewhere along the line, when I was in junior high, I was playing folk masses.
Oh.
So, first of all, I was at...
with guitar or bass?
I think I was playing bass. Okay. And I think it was originally on East 26th Street. Is that
East 26th Street?
Yeah, is that St. John's?
I think so.
Yeah. We were in the basement there doing something. And then we went to Colley Memorial, which is at St. Pat's in like the gym.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And we did that. And the gal who like headed this up, Franny Niebauer, she actually played quarterfox too, or accordion, but not there, though she played guitar. She had a little quartet that played Farmer's Tavern.
Wow.
I think that was out. It burned down.
Yeah, it did. It was out off of I know where
Fairview
it was.
Or somewhere.
Yeah, it's up past Fairview on the way to Edinburgh.
Right. So I think when I was 16, she said, "Oh, you know, we can use a bass player." So I was playing these bars.
Wow.
I was playing Farmer's Tavern on this Saturday night, playing string bass, and then I go play at these folk masses.
Yeah.
So
That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. So she told him that I was her nephew or something like that.
And you eventually play it like street church and you get involved with, I mean, we'll come to all that.
It's sort of interesting that at that time, you know, that I got involved probably because probably when I moved to Erie, since I wasn't going to a Catholic school anymore, I probably was going to the infamous CCD, and probably somebody told me about these things and hooked me up to play those. So that was my career in string bass.
Okay. All right.
So anyhow, so now we're back to the present day Stillwater.
Stillwater's playing. It's the three of you. It's you, Mark, and Kenny.
Right.
You're playing gigs. And you're in high school.
Right.
You're about to graduate, though, right?
Right. So this is at some point in time where, so I graduated in 70. And we had a couple other little changes at one point. I don't know exactly when, probably in 70. Let's go back to 70. So I graduated from high school. In the summer of 1970, there's a poster that there's a picture of the Frontier Park.
Sure. C.J. Bryan.
It says C.J. Bryan Sanity on top of this big lion.
Yeah.
And Stillwater played for that.
Right.
And it was a big concert. And somewhere I have a write-up that was in the paper, Erie Times, about that. I searched through my basement, could not find it.
Okay.
But I remember in that it mentions that I was going away to college. And they thought, oh, the band was going to break up.
Oh, okay.
So I did, for a semester and a half, go to Westminster.
Okay.
And I got a special dispensation to have my 1965 Chevy Impala down there, which I could not drive during the week. I had to go to the president's office and get my keys on the weekends.
Really?
To drive back to Erie to do gigs.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. So we did keep the band going. But after a semester and a half, a year and a half, I should say, not, I finished this semester, I said, you know, this really isn't working.
Yeah.
So I transferred up to Barron.
Okay. All right.
So you know, we kept playing. We were doing different shows. And like, I think around 71, this fellow by the name of John Kuhn,
no relation to
Steve Kuhn, to my knowledge, but we called him Mama Kuhn.
Okay.
Because he was kind of a heavy set guy. I think he called himself Mama Kuhn.
Okay.
He was really great on guitar. He had an SG. And so we wanted to do more kind of dual guitar things. We were doing things like Wishbone Ash and more dual guitar leads, Allman Brothers, this type of things. And I'm not really sure how long that lasted. But when he left, we're now seeing the beginnings of what ultimately became Quilleller.
Right.
So Tim McLaughlin joins us on guitar.
Yeah, how do you come into Tim's universe?
Well, Tim and Mark grew up in the same neighborhood.
Oh, okay.
They were friends. Tim lived on across from Harding on Lincoln, and Mark lived on Ottawa Drive, which is this little street around the corner.
Right, right.
And so they always knew each other, and I said, I think in junior high, probably played in some bands together.
Yeah.
Brass Box, maybe, or something.
Yeah, listen to episode number 2 with Tim. Yeah. There's,
right, exactly.
He covers, Tim's the ultimate historian.
Oh, yeah, he's a historian. I reached out to him for some of this stuff, too.
Yeah, Tim knows lots of stuff, and I figured, you know, a lot of the folks listening that remember from this time period, like Quilleller becomes a big band at the time, and this is a pivotal point in your musical career, it seems like, because it involves a trip, right?
I mean, right. So then somewhere along that time when Tim joined, Mark's younger brother, Scott, joined us on drums.
Okay.
I'm not sure really how that all happened. So now we have, you know, the two Twist brothers,
yeah.
Tim and myself, and we're now Quilleller. And people always say, where did that name come from? And I said, Mark dreamed it up. Matter of fact, he literally told a story that he had a dream.
Yeah.
About the guy. some guy named Eller who wrote with a quill pen.
Right.
I think that's all fabrication.
Right, right.
We didn't have an internet back then.
Yeah,
so
right.
We
right.
don't have any. So we're Quill Eller, and you know, like we, oh gosh, you know, we played all over the place. I mean, some of the reoccurring gigs that we had. One was down in Antlers, which somebody just mentioned to you the other day, and I think you were like, "Oh, Antlers! It's owned by Gannon now. It's their coffee house.
I know where it is because it was by where you and I worked at Lear everything. But I never realized until then that they had music back then because it's a tiny little Gannon bar.
It was people pack them in there.
I bet.
Oh, and we had like Marshalls. We had 100-watt Marshalls.
It was loud.
Yeah. For you musicians out there, we had the Super Lead 100s that didn't have a master volume. So if you wanted a thing to really crank, you just turn it up, as I used to say, until your ears bled.
Yeah.
You know.
So where else besides Antlers? I mean, some regular places where you play?
Well, I mean, boy, it's kind of hard to say. You mentioned we probably played in 1914.
As Quill Eller.
Maybe not.
That's all right.
Yeah,
He's getting out his phone and
looking at pictures here. I don't know. Oh, here's one. Here we go. That was Stillwater. So Stillwater, we played Paderewski Park because it was, it might have still been Stillwater when those guys joined, and then we just turned to Quilleller. So there was a kind of a changeover there. Oh, we did a lot of. So here's Quilleller, Perry Square.
Yeah. Yep, Perry Square, Arts Festival.
Arts Festival. Yep. We did all those.
Yep. And Tim probably has all this, you know, down to what you did every week. But
right. You know, that's the one thing, you know, it's like if it'd been nice to have kept a journal. On the way over here, I was thinking, now what would I have told my 13-year-old self if, you know, back then? Well, besides from the fact of don't get into music and go to med school.
Yeah.
That would be number one. But the other thing would be keep every piece of music gear, guitars, amps, effects that you ever own.
Don't sell it.
Because you'll be able to retire on that stuff.
Yeah, right.
And the other thing would be keep a journal of all the gigs and bands you've been in.
Right.
Because we didn't have Facebook. We didn't have cell phones.
Right.
We didn't have anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, well, let's see, what happened there? What happened then? You know, you find pictures here and there.
Yeah, and you got to do the lookups in the newspaper and everything. And, you know, so, I mean, you guys were playing in town and out of town, right? You were traveling.
Yeah, we also did, I forgot about this. For whatever reason, we got hooked into playing a lot of gigs down at Allegheny College.
Oh.
We do frat parties.
Like frat parties?
Oh, yeah, in the frat houses.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. Drunken frat parties.
Those must have been memorable.
Them doing the, what is it when they get on their back and kind of flip around? I don't know.
The crocodile. I don't know. Yeah, yeah.
One of those things.
Gotcha. All right.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Fun, I bet. Yeah.
So we did a lot of that. And, you know, like I said, the summer festivals. And
is Quill Eller playing any originals?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, Tim recently sent me a flash drive with some recordings that we did.
Oh, cool.
Some live recordings. And when I was going through looking for some pictures and things for this podcast, I came across a bunch of reel-to-reel tapes in my basement, which probably are ruined by now.
Right.
But we actually did some recording. We did a lot of original songs that we pretty much wrote as a group. Mark wrote a lot of the lyrics. And we actually at one point did do a recording. We had somebody come into Mark's house on Ottawa, set up a reel-to-reel in the kitchen, ran all these wires down in the basement, and we recorded this demo tape.
Okay.
The infamous demo tape, which we took on the infamous trip.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
Right.
So,
right. And what would you describe Quill Eller's music as? Like hard rock at the time?
Well, at the time, I would say it was, you know, on the heavier side, you know, kind of inspired by things like Zeppelin, Black Sabbath at the time,
yeah,
James Gang, that type of thing. trying to think who else was in that vein. Probably like, you know, Steve Marriott, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
So we had quite a few originals, but one of the things that was sort of interesting about this band, we became somewhat, I use it loosely because it has a different connotation now, sort of a jam band. Not how we understand it today.
Okay.
You know, like a Grateful Dead or anything like that.
Right.
But we would be doing songs and we'd get in the middle of a song and we would just sort of get in this free form type of thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Mark would start playing a little riff on a bass. And then Tim or I would say, oh, let's repeat that. And we'd do a harmony or something. And we would do these riffs. Sometimes they became other songs. Sometimes they became then an integrated part of that song.
Yeah.
You know, maybe in the middle of a Zeppelin song, we were going into this jam.
Sure.
You know? Gotcha. We do it a few times now it's part of the song. You know?
Yeah.
And the next time, you know, it's just like, hey, just start playing something and have everybody follow. And it was a riot.
And you and Tim are both lead players.
Yes.
So was there just constant trading off, you know, who's playing rhythm, who's playing lead? Or
probably. I don't think there was.
But there wasn't like, oh, you're just going to be the rhythm player
in
this band.
No,
you're going to be,
no.
You guys went back and forth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, in some songs, you know, there might be two different leads, you know, maybe, you know, there was an earlier solo and then a latter solo whatever. And somewhere along the lines, I actually bought a keyboard. It wasn't very good.
Huh.
And we did, the only song that I really remember was doing Steely Dan, Ricky Don't Lose That Number.
Okay.
And I was playing piano on it.
Interesting.
You know, so and you can imagine, you know, electronic pianos back in those days, especially cheap ones, you know, weren't that great.
Right, right.
You know, so.
And you knew enough to play.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you
because actually, when I was...
Did you study piano too?
I'll have to send you a picture of this. When I was in junior high, at some point my parents said, well, you know, if you want to do this music thing, you're going to have to learn how to play piano.
Yeah.
If you ever really wanted to consider music school, I mean, I don't know what I was thinking. You know,
right.
They said, you have to take lessons. So I started taking piano lessons with this little old lady or whatever up the street. And I had to do a recital.
Oh.
Probably at one of the piano stores downtown. I don't remember which one it was.
Sure.
I actually have the program at home. I'll scan it and and literally I'm like the biggest kid, you know. They're all like little kids.
Oh yeah. Gosh.
And they're playing their, you know, circles around me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I had to play that. So I knew
you knew enough to chords, play Ricky, you know. Don't lose
yeah,
that
yeah,
number.
Right.
Gotcha. All right.
So and that's about all. Right now, you know, the only song I can still play is Let It Be. So
all right.
So if you ever need that, I'm good. So Tim and Mark were a year behind me in high school, and I think Scott was another year behind. So there's some question about actually when this happened, somewhere between 73, 74, that summer, Quiller decides to make a road trip to L.A.
Right.
And we're going to get a record contract.
In that van that said Stillwater? Or
No.
Gone,
oh, no. It was in the big box truck that we bought from the Times.
That's right. The old paper delivery truck,
yes,
right?
Indeed. Yeah. Now, there's a picture of that.
Yeah.
So we had that, and Jim Moran, our sound man, had a car. And so we took a car.
But there's no plan other than we're going to L.A.
Oh, right. Mark had the name of somebody.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly where he got it. Tim tells us better. It was like, I don't know if it was on a record or a poster or something.
Yeah, I think Tim has told me this story.
Something they found. So we go out to L.A. I don't know where we first hit this, but they Tim and Mark waltz into Capitol Records. It's that iconic building.
Right. The round building. It looks like a stack of records.
Yeah, yeah. They walk in there. I mean, you couldn't do that today.
Right.
They walk in there, go upstairs. They said, where's so-and-so's office? They find this guy and said, hey, we're a band. You know, we want you to listen to the tape. I said, how'd you get in here? How do you have my name? I said, well, we found out here. He goes, well, I don't do that. I'm, you know.
That's not how this works.
Yeah. You need to talk to the A&R people. I do marketing or finance or some crazy thing, you know. It's like, and we're like, and somewhere along the line, I believe, at least in my memory, was that maybe they didn't even listen to the tape. They probably didn't, but somewhere along the line, they said, well, you know, you might want to go to the East Coast in Boston, that area, because that's where things are really happening now.
Hmm.
And we're like, we just drove
from
the Great Lakes region to here.
Yeah.
And said, so can't help you. So that was a little deflating. So we didn't have money. We didn't have gigs. We slept on the beach.
Yeah.
And got kicked off more than one beach. The one that sticks in my mind mostly, I don't know exactly which one this was, if it was Redondo Beach or some other beach. But in the middle of the night, all of a sudden, we see these huge lights. And, you know, you're asleep, right? And you see this, like, monster come at you, these big headlights or whatever. It was the beach cleaners, these big machines they had. Oh. Like trucks would go through and sift the sand.
Oh, really?
And we're just laying there in the middle of the beach. You
yeah.
know? So we kind of get out of the way and, like, you know, we would have been run over.
Yeah, right.
So we started, like, sleeping underneath the lifeguard chairs. They're big things, you know, until the cops showed up and booted us
right,
out.
Right.
And we moved on to some other beach. But we did, well, it wasn't really a gig. We did a tryout on the strip, on the Sunset Strip.
Oh.
Tim tells this better. So, but I will recount the story a little bit. There was two places. There was Gazzari's, which was a quite a popular club.
Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah.
And across the street from that, I believe, down the street was Filthy McNasty's.
Okay. All right.
I guess kind of popular. But we went into Gazzari's one night, and there was this band playing, this cover band. And we jokingly call them the Van Heusen Band. You can probably see where this is going.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It was Van Halen. Yeah. But they weren't doing originals back then. I think they were pretty much just a cover band.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Just kind of making money, doing whatever.
Right.
So we did get a tryout at this other place, had to use somebody else's gear. We didn't really get a gig. Somewhere along the line, we hooked up with somebody that got us a gig on the beach somewhere or some kind or in a park. I can't remember.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, I know. It's, you know.
It was like 73, 74. It's a long time ago.
One of the fellows who was with us, who was actually a roadie, he got tired of all that. He went home. He left.
Okay. You know,
so.
Yeah.
So we headed back and kind of stuck it out for a little while. But at that point, so I had graduated from college now in 74.
Oh, so you were still going to college throughout all of this. Oh,
right,
okay. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so I came back and went to Barron.
Okay.
And I ultimately graduated from there with a bachelor's in psychology.
You and I both.
Yeah.
I have a bachelor's in psychology from Barron, too.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Really helps you out, didn't
it? That's right. That's why we were in a band together.
So we came back and we were still doing a gig. So I'm trying to think of some other place we used to play. I think it was the Landmark on 26th Street.
Right.
And maybe, was it the Winery across the street? I'm not sure.
Down the road a little bit.
Yeah.
By the
interstate.
Yeah.
Some different places we were still playing.
Sure.
But at that point, so now I'm graduated from college. I'm thinking more in my mind, I need to settle down a little bit
more. Yeah, you're the oldest guy in the band.
Yeah. I should maybe get a job, you know.
Right.
My parents are probably saying, what are you going to do? You know, you're going to get a job. So so I did get a job. And I think then around that point, the band decided they wanted to do something else. They wanted to continue to pursue this.
Oh, okay.
So we parted ways. They actually got another bass player, Ken DeGabo, and Mark went to just being the lead singer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. And listen to episode number 2.
Right.
With Tim McLaughlin. And you can hear his stories about them going to Chicago.
Ah, yes. Right, right. Yeah.
So,
I've seen those pictures too.
So I left the band at that point. So there were some other things in between there. So, you know, my next big venture was Red, White, and Blueberry.
Right.
But somewhere in the midst of there, not even maybe for just a part of a year, it wasn't that long, I was in a band. It was a soul funk band.
Greatest name ever.
The Funky Stygian Hue Movement.
Love it. Love it. Yeah.
So Frank Williams, who was actually a band director, was a school teacher. He played saxophone.
Okay.
Little wiry guy.
Yeah.
You know, just a great, did I say sax? He was a trombone player.
Sorry. Oh, okay.
He was a trombone player. And then we had Brett Clark on sax. We had a trumpet player. We had a vocalist. And Richard Nixon on bass.
That was his real name?
That was his real name.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And we played mostly out of town in So I don't know how I can say this politically correct. We're mostly, you know, it was me and the horn players were the only white guys in the band. So we played like a lot of, I guess at the time you would consider black clubs.
And it's interesting, like some of the stuff that I saw for the funky Stygian hue movement, that's a mouthful. They describe you as jazz rock. And I don't know, that doesn't seem to fit, you know.
I mean,
it's you played places like, of course, you played the Summer Festival of the Arts. And I don't know if you were with them at the time. The OIC Egyptian Ball at the Erie Eye Center, which was at 18th in Holland. You played in 74, the band, if you were with them, Masters of the Touch Art Show and Concert. And then, of course, you played The Place, which eventually became The Alternative and all that on McClelland.
Well, we did a lot. We did, you know, some of the top 40 tunes of the time. And
but not really jazz rock.
Not jazz rock. Maybe because we had three horn players.
Okay, yeah, because there's so many times I read these articles and they mislabel the type of music it is, you know. So,
That'd be like saying the groove is jazz rock.
Right. Okay, perfect.
Know,
yeah.
You have some writer say, oh, that was a sax player and a trumpet player. So, you know, they said that was a just sort of a short jaunt in that, but it was fun. Thankfully, there aren't any pictures because at one point, we had matching outfits.
Did you really?
Oh, yes. Okay. Green satin bell bottoms and green glitter pullover shirts with hoods on them.
With hoods?
Yeah, we wear them down. We wouldn't wear them over. Maybe the singer would put his hood on. But
I wish there were pictures. If anybody out there has
green
pictures,
glitter
we're
material.
Willing to pay for those.
Somebody's wife made these things.
Absolutely.
Was like, they were crazy.
I'm sure they were very breathable, easy.
Oh my gosh, they were. Yeah. So that was interesting.
So that's like you come back, you're out of Quill Eller, you do a little bit with the funky stitches. You,
and then so that refers to the River Styx,
right? Yes. Right. Yeah, and so Red, White, and Blueberry at the time is a big band in town. They're already playing. Like we mentioned, Joel was their manager. Of course, it has Marty Lee as the guitar player. You got Pat Tellerico playing guitar.
John Erickson on bass. And Bert Rutkowski on drums.
Bert, who has the biggest drum set in the world.
Right. And so actually that's, I don't know the, there was a guitar player maybe prior to Pat.
I think you're right.
Or Marty. You have to listen to their episodes.
Or either one of them. Yeah, they talked about that.
I think Pat was in with another guitar player. When he left, Marty came in. So they had been together for a number of years.
Right. They were super popular.
Several years. And I remember going seeing them.
You know,
they played these block parties. They played teen parties. They did all these different things.
Had professional sound and lights. Yeah. Not professional, but I mean, it was at the time, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, also, it makes me think when I started saying things we were playing, one of the places probably was Stillwater Quill Eller at the time. Occasionally, we would get to play somewhere like Rainbow Gardens.
Oh, really?
So you had to be in the union.
Oh.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
So any musicians of that era,
we
all joined the union because Bagnoni would come and check cards.
Yeah. Was the Rainbow Garden like people would put on parties or events with multiple bands or something?
I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of the stuff was usually sponsored by the radio stations.
Oh, that's what it was. You're right. I've heard that now.
Jethead dances there.
Yeah.
I used to go there before I was played. Bands like the RK4 when I was younger.
Yeah, we'd go there.
They'd have a DJ.
That's where I've heard of it.
Frank Martin would be DJing.
Yeah, right.
Johnny Holiday.
I just saw RK4.
So, yeah, all of a sudden these other things pop into my head. So now it's in the summer of 75, Pat announced he was going to move.
Right.
Pat was actually my barber.
He was my barber, too. Yep.
He, if you see the pictures that will be online, my atrociously long hair in Quill Eller, and then Pat gave me my first shag haircut.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So you'll see him. You'll see some of that in the Red, White, and Blue pictures. Pat was.
So Pat decides he's going to leave town. Marty's still in the band, but then Marty decides to join the Pulse.
Yeah.
I think that's how you ended up
right
getting the call. Right.
Right. Well, actually, Pat left the band, but he didn't move out of town yet.
Okay.
I think, I'm not sure what his other reasoning was.
Okay.
Maybe he's, for his business, he was burned out, health reasons. I'm not really sure. Because he comes in the picture a little bit later on, Pat does.
Oh, okay. And does Frank Grotto, is he join when you do? Or?
Yes.
Oh,
yes, okay. At the same time.
Oh,
so
okay.
basically summer of 75, and I have this directly from Joel Miller. So
yes.
Pat said he was leaving. And Marty knew Frank Grotto because they're both from Northeast.
Oh, okay.
And he had asked Frank to replace Pat. But before Frank played any gigs, Marty decided to leave as well.
Ah, okay.
So I replaced Marty.
Marty.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay.
So we were rehearsing, and Pat and Marty kept playing gigs. This is from Joel. He says, on June 28th, 1975, Red, Red, and Blueberry headlined the Erie Festival Arts.
Yep.
On State Street and stage. And back then, they would put the stage at State and North Park Row.
Yeah.
Facing south.
Right.
And
right.
So the whole street and the parks were just filled with people.
Yeah.
And so we were headlining the biggest night of this. So Marty and Pat came out and did a gig, and they did what they refer to as the passing of the pick.
Yeah.
And so then we go out, and I think Frank actually ripped his pants on the first song. I had to go back and change. So we finished the night out, and actually I think it says our first full gig as that new band. We played the Surf Club in July of 75.
In Jamestown.
Oh, and actually Joel says it was his 21st birthday.
All right.
And so we, Red, Red, and Blueberry was sort of an interesting band at the time. I'll preface this at this point. I was only in the band for a year.
Right.
That was the last year. But we basically took it on the road. We were playing places out of town, the Corral, I think in Cleveland, Melody, and some different places. We played some things in town.
Okay.
But we were playing a lot of out-of-town gigs. We had a road crew at the time. We had sound man. We had light man. We had special effects.
Yeah.
And then we would have some other roadies perhaps helping us. So it was they had vans or trucks or whatever. So then John Erickson and I would ride with him in his big Buick or whatever he had. We'd ride to the gig. We'd get out, plug our guitars, and everything was set up for us.
Yeah.
I tuned up my guitar on the old Kahn Strobe tuner. Didn't have digital tuners back then.
Right, right.
And plug in my Marshall half stack just with a Les Paul straight in.
Yeah,
you know,
no effects.
No effects, really.
Yeah.
Later on, had a tape Echoplex and a wah-wah. That was it. We played. And then the gig would end. John and I would pack up our stuff and go home.
Yeah.
But we had, for the time, quite a light show.
Yeah.
We had, Bert's drums. We had a big backdrop with our logo on it. By that time, we were kind of toned down to calling it RWBB.
Oh, really?
Because Red, Red, and Blueberry was a mouthful. So we had RWBB. If you see that poster, yellow poster.
Yep.
So there's the story behind the poster. That's actually me.
Right, right.
So
the silhouette of the Scott silhouette. Playing
guitar. Somebody had taken a picture. I'm doing this kick.
Right.
You know, we're kind of a really high energy band. We kind of changed a little bit. You know, we were a little heavier, more high energy, I suppose. I mean, other Red, Red, Blue. I mean, Marty, for God's sakes. I mean, Pat, they're great.
And we were just all covers, right?
Right.
No original.
But with Frank was a little bit more glam, you know, so to speak.
Yeah.
We wore a little bit of makeup.
Gotcha.
He wore makeup. He had costume changes. His girlfriend made him all these costumes.
Wow.
I had, more satin pants. I had purple satin pants.
Yeah.
And some different outfits. John had a outfit with this big furry white coat and these white velvet pants.
I see where this is going.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. So we were doing all this crazy stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, at some point, Bert decided to leave the band.
Okay.
He had some personal, possibly health reasons. Some reason Bert Rakowski decided he couldn't be in the band anymore. In fact, I just saw Bert Branislaus,
right.
At my Oliver's gig like a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
We had a nice chat. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Bert's, Branislaus is a piano player.
Oh, yeah.
He does not play drums.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
So He was studying piano when we were in the band. In fact, in his setup, I don't know if I have a picture of this, but he used to have a Wurlitzer EP behind him. He would spin around and play piano. He played like the beginning of like a Bad Company song.
Really?
Or like he'd play the part in Rocky Mountain Way.
Yeah.
Play like a piano part.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Wow. And he had these drums when he'd stand up. Well, Bert's really tall. And he'd stand up. He had a mirror behind him so he could see all his drums when he'd stand up and do these.
Yeah, I always heard about his drum set just being giant. He had a gong.
Yeah. It was madness.
Yeah.
All right. It was great. So Bert decided to leave, and we got another drummer for a while. And then that one, he didn't work out. And then we got another drummer, and he worked through the summer, and then we basically disbanded. And according to the best of my knowledge, our last gig was July 23rd and 24th of 76, actually.
Okay.
Because Joel documented this for me, Friday and Saturday, at the Earthworks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay.
Which Tim always liked to call the Earthworms.
Yeah. You
know, so Earthworks. We did do a something earlier in that year, played on a live TV show on, I think it was WQLN. Yes, during the WQLN auction.
Wow.
This was in May of 76. Just as a side note, we played every afternoon, Monday through Thursday from 5 to 6. We would play live during the auction.
That's wild.
Yeah.
They don't do that anymore.
No. Because and it's funny because I was talking to Phil Thomas, who was one of our roadie guys, and he said, he goes, oh, yeah, they were there during that. And he says he remembers very clearly that during that show, I called him and I'm not sure who else was there, one of our other roadies, to come out on camera because I knew their moms were watching.
Oh, nice.
And he says, these guys come out because they're really cute, you know.
I don't know. Give them a little exposure.
I don't remember saying that.
That's wild.
Yeah. So you know, that was, you know, one of my claims to fame. You know, this band was together for 10 years probably, and I played in the last year.
The last
you know.
Year, right.
Yeah. So, but it was a great last year, you know. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, after that, and you could correct me, but it seems like you get into Clockwise, you do Watership Down,
right.
You kind of, it's much mellower stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and it's in some ways.
Not necessarily Clockwise.
So I think it was like, another reason why Red, White, and Blueberry disbanded too was that Frank was also our rhythm guitar player, Frank Grotto.
Yeah.
And I heard actually a few years ago he died.
Yeah.
But he had injured his hand and couldn't play guitar anymore. So he felt he really couldn't add to that, you know.
Oh,
so
okay.
he left. So the band disbanded. And then actually Frank and John joined with a couple other folks for a band called Speed Queen.
Right.
And John continued to wear his fuzzy white jacket.
Right.
And that ended, eventually Frank left and they sort of got somebody else and they got... They had one drummer later on, they got Steve McConnell, but that eventually became the Snowmen.
Right.
And it was, you know, whether it was inspired by that jacket or whatever, I have to believe somehow
I
it
knew
was.
That's where you were going when you said the white jacket, because I knew that they eventually, Speed Queen eventually
But the funniest
Snowmen.
Thing is, when it started being the Snowmen, John really didn't
want to
be
all that stuff.
Wear all that. He
wear
would go
makeup.
Wireless and, like, play behind the stage, I heard.
Yeah.
You know. So he ended up actually moving out of town for a job.
Sure, right.
And
and
so then, you know, and we all know the history of the Snowmen. So
anyhow.
But somewhere in, I would say in 76, 77, I got together with actually my wife at the time, Gail, and Pat, and we started this acoustic
trio. Pat Tallarico. Right, yeah.
This acoustic trio called Watership Down. Which was the name of a book about rabbits that I was reading at the time. So,
popular book.
Yeah, popular book.
And this is like folk rock, country rock.
Oh, yeah. That yeah, type well, of thing. We did, because we had the female vocalist, we did at the time, very popular, we did a lot of Heart, Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks.
Okay.
Stevie Nicks had just joined Fleetwood Mac, so that first album was just phenomenal tunes on there, so we were learning a lot of that stuff.
Okay.
I'm not sure how long it lasted. The only gigs I remember clearly doing were Befwick's in Westbury Plaza.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, if I think back, and I don't really know, but there was the some acoustic acts, but mostly like solos, like John Imms. We knew John, and he did his solo acoustic act and that
and
type
Pat
of thing.
Pat was not doing solo stuff, right? At the
yeah,
time,
maybe
was he?
Maybe he was, or was trying to do that or something.
Right.
And so I guess he was my barber. So we started doing this trio. We practiced in his basement, you know. And so we started playing and doing that. And then somewhere along the line in 1977, you probably have the actual date somewhere.
I don't have the date right here.
It's in your book. Yeah. A little shameless plug for Dan's book, 9 Years of Rock. Buy it.
For the one page that has a picture of Scott.
Yeah, which is not very clear. It looks like a Polaroid or something. And the story is actually about Keith Fischeko, but it's a great story, but I won't tell it, sir.
But you opened for whom?
Gino Vannelli. So I think Pat probably knew maybe DeCesar or Engler or one of those folks that were doing that, you know. And because it was sort of a last minute, because my recollection is that if you look at the advertisements for that concert, it was one of those opening act to be announced.
Absolutely, yeah.
We were not on the poster. Yeah, we were not. Right. You know. And so we did our little shtick there. Keith Fischeko came and ran sound for us, and everybody thought he was one of the Vannelli brothers because he had this long black wavy hair, you know. So we called him Guido.
And great. How was the response? Do you remember?
Oh, well, in Erie, it was not very good.
I bet, yeah.
Not that we weren't good,
yeah,
but they wanted to see Gino.
Yeah, he was
All
he was
these
hot.
Women were there coming to see Gino, right? And much to our surprise, they asked us to play the next night at the Scottish Rite Temple, I think it was called, in Newcastle, Pennsylvania.
That's cool.
Which was kind of like a Warner Theater, but I remember that the sides, the way the seats went up, it was really steep. That's all I remember. It's really strange, like, you know, the way it was set up. I don't know, acoustically, maybe it was an opera house. I don't know. But so we played there, and we had a really good response. It really liked us.
Yeah.
But I remembered that we were down the hall from Gino's dressing room, and I don't know who started it, but either Gail or Gina were doing vocal warm-ups. I think he was doing vocal warm-ups. So she started doing this, and there's this little battle
of
vocal backups back and forth.
Interesting.
So
interesting memory.
Yeah. So it's funny because I was going through my stuff last night in the basement. I came across a couple old Erie Star magazines, and one of them had a big article about ATV, which was Arlette, Tellerico and Fischeko, which started out as an acoustic trio and ended up being a full band with different members, not always being ATV at the time. But in this article, it specifically says that the kind of the precursor, you know, it's like this idea of the acoustic trio was Watership Down. And Pat decided to start that, you know, with those guys. Yeah. I'm not saying, you know, he jumped the Watership, you know.
Sure, right, yeah.
You know, it was kind of like, you know, those were his friends, and I think they had some more ability to some more marketing, and they had some connections and that type of thing. But there weren't a lot of that. Now, nowadays, you know, you can't walk down the street without bumping into an acoustic act, right?
Yeah, that's what I hear. Yeah.
You know, there's those Rankin and Michelle. Yeah. You know. I mean, two of them, you know.
That's right,
you know,
yeah.
You know, so obviously... So that broke up. Then somewhere in 77, I believe, I became acquainted with some of the folks from Clockwise. Well, actually, they were Jonah.
Yeah.
They were a Christian, contemporary Christian progressive rock band.
Right.
And at that time, it was Angelo Natale, Mike Watson, Bob Tome, Tom Stone, and Paula Grack. And we had gone to see them a couple times. And so, as the story goes, they recorded an album, had the album all done and everything, and were getting ready to get it done or finalize it. And Bob decides to leave the band.
Right.
Now, you talked to Bob, so they can listen to that, you know, why he left or whatever. So he leaves the band. They get a guitar player, Dave Kostick. I'm not sure how they knew him. He moved in from Minnesota,
yeah,
or Milwaukee,
right,
or something, from somewhere else. So he moved to town to play with the band. And then they decided to ask Gail and I to join the band.
Oh, okay.
So we were seven-piece band at the time. We had two female vocalists, two lead guitar players. Yeah, Bob, it took two of us to do your parts. but they were very complicated, too.
Yeah.
So we did all original. I'd like to say we were progressive, especially at the time, very influenced by things like Genesis, even pre-Phil Collins.
Sure.
Yes, that type of thing.
So the guitar parts that are on the album are Bob.
Are Bob, yes.
But your face is on the album.
My face. There is in the album liner. If you don't have that, I will send it to you.
Yeah.
There is a picture of Dave and I down at the bottom. Me playing my Les Paul.
The new kid. Or
says
something.
New kid. Yeah, new kid. Well, because there was some thought we were going to do one final song as a precursor to our next album and have us play, but it just didn't pan out.
Got it.
Instead, Gail did this short little piece called, I think, The Thief or something. We had a trilogy called Rich Man, Poor Man, Beggar Man, Thief.
Poor Man, Beggar.
I guess that's four parts. Because we thought we were going to do another album, but that never came to be.
Got it.
So now we're in Clockwise. It's 1977 or 78, actually, around that time. Let's find my notes here. So according to Angelo, the Clockwise album was finished in 76, and it was released in 78, and that's around the time I came in, so maybe 77, late 77, early 78. So I joined Clockwise at the time, and I actually was working at Hammett Mental Health, and actually went not part-time for a while. I think I took off every Friday so we could rehearse and travel because we were going all over the place. Yeah, we toured the U.S. and Canada, a lot in the Midwest.
This is Christian rock. I mean,
yes.
There was a circuit for that.
Well, this is interesting. There was a circuit for that, and we did a lot of that where we'd go and play at these fellowships. And also, we opened for other more nationally known Christian artists. Probably not people you would hear. Randy Stonehill was one.
He was a big deal back then.
Yeah. Marty McCall and Fireworks. The Resurrection Band that later became the Res Band. DeGarmo and Key. So we're touring around doing all these different shows. And Pete Natale was doing some bookings.
Right.
He was doing some bookings for us. In fact, we got on a circuit where we were doing secular colleges. Pete would sometimes book us for these other colleges. I don't remember the college.
Yeah.
He probably does. But we opened for Black Oak, Arkansas.
Wow.
Jim Dandy to the rescue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy
they had this 16-year-old, I think, maybe younger, phenom guitar player.
Oh.
Yeah. So here we are. We're doing our progressive. I mean, it was, I have to say, the Clockwise probably was one of the hardest bands I ever had to play in because Angelo wrote parts for guitar players that weren't meant to be played on guitar.
Gotcha.
He was a guitar player. And he wrote parts for the vocalists, you know, and Paul said she was just singing them, you know.
Yeah.
And some pretty complicated things if you listen to that album.
Yeah.
You know? But anyhow, so we're going to open for Alwyn Wall Band at Mercyhurst. I think Paula didn't even want to do the gig
She didn't
want to do the gig.
Yeah.
She had kind of a boyfriend or something. I'm not sure what the deal was there.
Yeah. You know?
And sorry, Paula. I was actually just down to their house last
week. I remember week, she so. Saying they like basically had to convince her because she had a date with a guy
or
her boyfriend or something. Right. And then she didn't want to do it. And so she comes up to Mercyhurst to do it. And she's already unhappy.
There's the keyboard player.
Yeah.
Kind of a wacky guy. On stage, he has this one shtick where he puts these big goofy glasses on for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe it has something to do with the song.
Yeah.
And she's watching. He keeps looking at me. What's with this guy? And she tells the story better, so you can listen to her episode. But basically, he was keen on her, Phil Holmes. And dating and getting married,
right,
and having
right.
a family. That's... So she left the band.
Yes.
She left the band. And so we're down by one person.
Still, Gail's still in the band.
Yes. Gail's right. still in the band.
Yeah.
And then, sure, which point all this happened. So, but then Gail was pregnant with our daughter, Kelly. So she couldn't travel
right.
at a certain point. So now we're just the five guys.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how quick this happened. Then Mike was going to go into more full-time ministry, our bass player. So Dave switches to bass. So we're like not that long removed. We were a seven-piece band.
Yeah.
Now we're a four-piece rock band.
Yeah.
Guitar, right. bass, drums, you know, keyboards.
Yeah.
But now with this four-piece configuration, we decide we're going to go down, play, open up for DeGarmone Key in Memphis, and then we're going to go down to Key West.
Oh, wow.
And play there, because there's some people we know that were down there doing some
and
things.
You have a full-time job.
Apparently.
Okay. All right.
I don't know how I did that.
A daughter on the way.
Yeah, right, yeah, right, right.
Okay.
It's rock and roll, I guess.
Yeah.
So we make this trip down to Key West. We play, and it was weird. If my recollection was that when we played in Memphis, it was right around Easter, and it was raining, and we played this theater with the DeGarmone Key, and I think we went to Graceland.
Yeah.
In the rain, of course, you know. Made it down to Key West, did some shows down there that we had.
Wow.
I think the bus broke down in Atlanta, and it was like probably an Easter Sunday or something. We couldn't get a part. I don't
sure.
know.
Yeah.
You know, we came back, but the last gig we actually did was in January of 1980.
Okay.
So I was probably in that band a couple of years.
Okay.
Some different configurations.
Yeah.
But I tell you, like I said, musically doing all the original stuff and the thing, it was a great learning experience. And I kind of came away from that and some of my other experiences, you know, and I'd always say to other folks, get in a band where there's people that you have to work to be that good.
Sure.
You know right. that you're not the best person in the band.
Right.
I guess there's always somebody, but they probably don't think they are.
Yeah, right,
but, you know, in my perception, there's all these other great musicians. They made me play...
Harder.
Work harder,
yeah, right,
you know, and
right.
practice and that type
yeah.
of thing. So, so it kind of just disbanded, and that was it with Clockwise, unfortunately. So I went with maybe, you know, a couple of years not really
right.
playing in a band.
And even, you know, I mean, we're moving into the band Britain, and even
yeah.
the articles that I read about it, you know, they would talk about, and they say it started in 82, but they describe you guys as many of the members had been retired from music for a while.
Yeah, I read that,
you know?
Too. I guess I probably was out of the scene for a couple of years.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Because all you guys that are in this band, although I don't know some of the guys. I mean, I
yeah.
know Pat Ross,
right.
I know Chuck
yeah,
Leone
yeah, yeah.
and you, but the other guys, Dave Shanti, Steve Nick, Mike Lurdy, had they been in other popular bands? I don't know their names.
Dave Shantz was in a band with, I think, Tom Stone and Valamont.
Oh, I know the last.
Yeah. Lee Valamont. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just
blanked out there for a minute. Might have been, you know, back in high school. I think
okay.
they had some, because they kind of knew each other. I think there were some different, I don't know if it was The Wall. There was a band called The Wall, those guys are in. I'm not sure. But I know that they had played together at some point. I can't give a chronology of that.
But you gave a nice copy that I'll include in the photos, you know, the article that I read. There's actually two articles
right,
about
both in the
Britain.
Erie Star, yeah.
yeah.
One was right after our first gig, or
okay,
the first
yeah.
gig in 82. We actually rehearsed the summer of 82 with Dave Shantz on vocals, Chuck Leone, fantastic keyboard player,
yeah.
Steve Nick on bass, and Mike Lurdy on drums. And Steve Nick and Mike Lurdy kind of came as a package.
Okay.
They knew each other, and they had played together. And we practiced, and then our first gig was actually at the Girard Hotel in fall
yeah.
of 1982. We used to play there several times, and we just kept working and working and honing our skills. Again, we were kind of, at the time, doing more of the, I mean, it was popular music. It really wasn't called progressive anymore. I mean, if Kansas was progressive.
Yeah, you were doing Kansas and
Genesis
and
Journey.
And
so it
right,
was kind
yeah.
of that type of thing. That was really, there was a lot of keyboards. So, like I said, we really were playing a lot. We played That's back when bands would typically play like 10 to 2.
Sure, right.
You'd book like a Friday and a Saturday. We played the French Quarter.
Oh, yeah.
Fridays and Saturdays. I think, you know, we were sort of a staple band there. Kidder is another band that was there all the time. I'm trying to think. Probably Easy.
Yeah.
Some of those bands. Yeah. You know, all great bands. And, we actually had a... We had a guy come in and do our Rocky Chase, did our sound. We had the younger Burek brother, Steve.
Yeah.
He was just a kid back then. I don't know. He might have been 16 or 17 running our lights.
Right.
And in a bar, you know. So, you know, we again, put on a
show.
High energy show.
Right.
Dave was a really good singer and really had a lot of energy, you know, trying to get people on the dance floor.
Right.
And I was always running around, much to Chuck's dismay, acting like a madman, you know. And
eventually Mike leaves and Pat comes in, right?
Pat Ross
joins us on drums. This is before Endless Summer for Pat, right? I'm not sure either.
Because that band was sort of an Endless Summer.
It was. Yeah. You can listen to the Mike Lotz episode for that history.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, Pat's a great drummer. And I know he was pretty young at the time and when he joined. But the one thing I thought was interesting about Britain, and I've always thought of them as a cover band and a high-powered, energetic cover band, but you had originals.
Yes.
And did you ever record those?
Not officially.
Okay.
I have some cassettes at home,
oh.
And I'm not sure. I think when we did gigs that Rocky would set up a tape deck with a microphone, probably like a mic, and then a line out from the board. We had a number of originals that we all sort of worked on.
I was going to say to you, you know, you're coming out of Clockwise, which is, you know, all originals.
Yes.
You know, I mean, do you as a musician at this point, do you have a preference? You know, because you've played in both, you know, I mean.
Even when I was in Clockwise, I was still playing somebody else's songs.
No, that's good.
Because you know, we had the album and all the other songs.
Right.
We did do one of my originals.
Oh,
okay. We never had a chance to record it. Maybe if we had done another album. So that was kind of nice. But, you know, working with these guys, it was usually Dave would come in with an idea of like a lyric line or something. And I was good at riffs.
Okay.
And I would come up with like a little riff or something.
Yeah.
And then Chuck would add some keyboard parts. He could just play around and come up with anything, you know.
Right.
So it was fun doing. I have some of those recordings. I had to get them on a digital format sometimes. But that was really good. And unfortunately, we did lose Dave a number of years ago too.
Right.
But that again was one of those bands that I guess I was really, really proud of what we did. It was really a great band. I probably left prematurely. I left on my own. Looking back, I'm not quite sure why. It was just some personal reasons, whatever. They went on to add another guitar player, and then I think they became, then maybe Dave might have left, and they had a gal singing. They were Red Alert, I think it might have been.
Okay.
But, you know, kind of went that way. So, and it's kind of funny because not too much time passed by. I'm not really sure because I don't have any documentation about this. Somewhere after that, after the late 84, like maybe 85, 86, because my wife said I was in this band that I'm going to mention when we were dating. It was a band called The Touch.
Oh, I don't know this band.
It was very short-lived.
All right.
Dave Shaunce again on vocals.
Okay.
We got back together. Denny Fabrizi on keyboard. Some guy named Jim on bass. I don't know.
Poor Jim. Yeah, if you're listening, Jim.
They have a last name, Jim.
Yeah.
And Lee Valamont on drums.
Wow.
He was a guitar player.
Yeah.
But he wanted to be a drummer.
There's so many of musicians.
It was like, I think him and Dave cooked up this band so Lee
the
could
touch.
Play it.
And you didn't play that long?
No.
Yeah.
I think we kind of try to follow in suit of Britain, probably played French Quarter. I don't know if we ever played the Rook. I'm not sure.
Right. I mean, those were big rock clubs at the time. Sherlock's.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So does this lead into the final band of the 80s for you in Major League?
Yes.
Okay, so you reunite with Tim.
Yeah.
I mean, are you a lot of these bands, you've come in and they're already established.
Right. Oh,
but this one, did you start?
No, from scratch? Let me tell you how I started.
Oh, I didn't.
So that band existed. So that was, so it was Tim McLaughlin, Scott Twist, obviously, boyhood friends, you know.
Yeah, right.
And Steve Kuhn, who was another guy that they hung out with since they were like
growing up.
Yeah. So Steve was there, and their bass player. I should have thought about this a little bit longer, but he left, and I believe to go play with. Well, at some point he played with Tennessee Back Porch. So anyhow, he left. So I'm at a grocery store, hardware store somewhere, and I see Scott Twist. I said, what's going on? He goes, oh, you know, playing in Major League. He says, are you doing anything? No, I'm not playing. He goes, oh, hey, we need a bass player. You want to play? I go, I don't own a bass. I can play bass.
Right.
You know, I used to play bass, right?
Yeah.
In the orchestra. I can play bass. he goes, oh, we have a bass for you. Steve has a bass. Show up, you know.
So you were the bass player?
I was the bass player.
I didn't know that. So Scott or Tim was the guitar player.
Yeah, Tim was the guitar player. And then I came in as to cover bass.
Yeah.
Then eventually sort of morphed in where somewhere I thought I had a set list. Yes. Set list were shows Steve and I switching off on bass. So yeah. So we just kept splitting bass and guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, so I mean, yeah,
it was a crazy band. They were
it
fun.
Was it yeah. was so that was sort of the end of the 90s. As you said, I've been doing stuff since that.
Yeah, lots of stuff.
Right now, I'm in two bands and a couple of duos. So trying to cut back a little bit, but
you're in Key West Express.
Yes,
you're in Lucky Dog.
Yep.
Full bands,
yes.
And then you play duos with Jen
yes.
and
Katie.
And Katie.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those keep you plenty busy,
yeah.
You know,
busier than I want to. I'm, trying to cut back a little bit this summer as I get older and just trying to make more time available, you know, so my wife and I can do some
sure,
things,
right,
you know,
right.
It's just kind of gets to that point.
Well, you are an energetic guy, especially for 71 or whatever. And
we didn't mention our band.
We don't need to mention our band.
There's a picture.
Yeah, there's some pictures that I won't post.
It didn't last that long.
But it was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
I mean, you're the best guitar player I've ever played with, for sure. Basically, from all the history that we just described, that should be come as no surprise. All right, well, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks, Scott Campbell. This was a great, great trip, and I appreciate
thanks,
I loved playing with you. I always have, and I appreciate you coming on today. And again, if you're listening, make sure that you go look at all those photos, because I will post those on Facebook for now until I fix my crappy website. All right, thanks a lot. Hey, thanks for listening to Season 6 of the Erie Music History Podcast. Just a reminder that I do host a music night on the first Tuesday of the month at the JPT Foundation's Events Center. It's on West 38th Street in the plaza that's next to Our Lady of Peace Church. Starts from 6 o'clock, goes till 9 o'clock, totally free. BYO everything. You can bring in alcohol, food. There's a great pizza shop next door. There's a Subway in the plaza. We, of course, have our house band, the Fabulous Leftovers. They play for an hour, and then usually we open it up to an open mic, or we have some other prearranged acts that follow the Leftovers from probably around 7:15, 7:20 till 9 o'clock. So check that out, first Tuesday of the month. Thank you to the JPT Foundation for continually supporting this podcast. I appreciate it. Also, thanks to my buddy Angelo Phillips, who also threw us a few bucks for helping support the podcast. I appreciate that. You can go to Patreon if you'd like to contribute, or there's a Venmo also. You can find all of the episodes right now on any of the platforms that you listen to podcasts on. I have not been updating the actual website for the podcast, but you can also see the photos of the people that I interview for each episode on Facebook under Erie Music History Podcast. All right. Thanks a lot.